Good evening. Welcome to Home Fires Radio Show. With me in the studio are Captain Jim and Mary Binkley, owners of the Riverboats Discovery, but you call yourself still Riverboat Discovery. They've been, you call it plying the waters. I'm not good on nautical terms.
Oh, that's good enough.
Plying the waters of the Tanana and the Chena since 1950, and we're going to talk about their business and the boats and some of the life on the river. It's one of the things that's special, that's unique about Alaska, is the fact that much of it is only accessible by water. I heard the guest speaker for the Alaska commencement this morning, and he was talking about this whole area being originally settled by river. And there are many villages still along the Yukon that you don't reach by road. So this is a unique way to see Alaska.
Yeah, and some of its colorful past is brought out as we move along with our boats, as well as contemporary times, too. But our history, you know, goes way back in riverboating in Alaska. This, as a family, is our 87th year of doing this. Starting during the Gold Rush days, my dad started here up in Whitehorse and Yukon Territory. My two uncles were rivermen also. So you see, we've been at it a long time. This is my 45th year of operating boats here in the interior.
Well, there's no lack of experience. And you married into the business.
That's right.
I've met several people, young women, in fact, who came to Alaska as young women to work on the tugs that were going up and down to do some kind of crewing.
Out of Nenana, there's been freighting for years and years, you know, since the Alaska Railroad crossed the Tanana River. The railroad established a boating service to the lower Yukon, the Tanana River, and up as far as Fort Yukon, through the Yukon Flats. So that's been going a long time. And a number of women are cooks on the boats working out in Nenana, and they still operate out of there.
I know Diane Gertler said she lives in Manly and is married and, in fact, settled on the Yukon. But she said that was just her 2 years working those tugs. They're considered tugs.
You see, they had sternwheelers up until the end of World War II, and then the tugboats took over at that time, took over from the paddlewheelers.
Okay, let's go back. Let's start in the beginning. Let's go back to your father. How did he get to this area? Was he born in?
He was from Indiana. Been trained as a riverboat pilot on the Ohio River. And as a young man, he got the wanderlust, heard about the gold rush, came north since he'd been trained in riverboating. Why, it was just a natural for him to fall right into it. So that was the genesis of the whole thing.
He just got a job on an existing boat.
Yes, he did, and then he built his own. Started operating. Built a number of boats. Operated on the upper and middle Yukon for some time, then went down to the Susitna River when they were building the Alaska Railroad. And we have an article in the paper at home from the Wrangell Sentinel indicating that he was launching a boat on the mudflats near Ship Creek while they were surveying for the town of Anchorage. And he was taking supplies up to Susitna to help establish the Alaska Railroad.
Interesting. They pay well in those days?
Well, I'm not sure. Probably not. I think, of course, that's probably commensurate with the times. One takes the price of gold at that time and the price of gold at this time, and by major item, it's about the same, I think.
But he wasn't tempted to jump ship and start mining like him?
No, I don't think so. He had an interesting philosophy. His comment was that during a gold strike, a few fellas struck it rich. Most of them didn't make it, but every time he delivered a load of freight, he got paid.
Well, so a lot of the commercial developers actually felt that way.
Absolutely.
Fairbanks was, now my history's real rusty, but Fairbanks was started because this is where the boat stopped. It got wintered in.
Yes, well, the Lavelle Young came up the Tanana that was chartered by Captain Barnett, whose boat had been damaged in St. Michael. And he contracted with Charlie Adams, Captain Charlie Adams, who had the boat, the Lavelle Young. And as I understand it, the agreement was to go to a particular spot, which they were not able to reach, at 10 across above the mouth of the Chena. They had heard, so I understand, that there might be a way by going around through the Chena and out the other side to avoid a rapids above the mouth of the Chena. And they did so, and they weren't able to make it. And their agreement was that if he wasn't able to make it, he'd offload him at an appropriate spot, offload Barnett, and return his vessel to St. Michael. So that's the way it occurred.
And so they just stopped.
They
here
just picked a spot along the riverbank and said, "Here it is."
Therefore, Fairbanks. What is the access from here to Dawson? Is
one can go down the Chena to the Tanana, down the Tanana 250 miles, take a right turn and go approximately 500 miles to Dawson.
And was that a frequent
it was
route in the
days.
Very early days?
Yes, it was. You know, up until World War II, the old Golden Belt Tour started at Whitehorse with the steamboats. People would come to Skagway, go across the White Pass and Yukon Railway to Whitehorse, down the Yukon River to the junction of the Tanana and the Yukon, up the Tanana to Nenana, and take the train to Seward and catch the boat and go home again.
Uh-huh. The comments this morning were that much of this area was settled by the commercial companies who were operating sternwheelers delivering goods. It was the Northern Commercial
Company? Northern Commercial was one of the big ones. Mm-hmm.
And that was a Canadian company originally?
No, I'm not certain of that.
I don't know.
I don't think so. I think it was an American company. They may have purchased rights or properties from another company. There was the Alaska Commercial Company and the Alaska Trading and Transportation Company, mementos of those sternwheelers we have at home, some of the old things with those initials on it.
Mm-hmm.
ACC and the ATT.
And they were, the Northern Commercial Company was in Fairbanks for quite some time.
Oh, I should say, they're a very strong company. We delivered a lot of goods for the Northern Commercial Company years ago, along the river.
It is amazing to me when I look at the old pictures in the archive collection of Fairbanks, the number of sternwheelers here in the summer. Of course, at that time, that was the only way that supplies could get in, and we had to be supplied for the entire winter as well. What has changed about the river that would allow, I mean, the pictures of downtown, you know what I'm talking about.
Sure.
Just how many boats would be in at a time? Look like 15, 20?
Probably not that many. It might have looked like that with the barges and the boats all tied up together, but there were a number of them that made it in here. And I understand at one time they had a boat a day into Fairbanks from Tanana, and a half a dozen boats could handle that very easily. But at one time, you know, the Tanana River came down through Fairbanks. It was called the Chena Slough because out at the dike, they diverted the water in the 40s away from Fairbanks as a flood control measure, one of the early ones, because much of the Chena was Tanana River water.
Uh-huh.
Fairbanks is just on a huge island of the Tanana River. And then with the various flood controls and so on, we're down to where just Chena River water now comes down. But when I first started boating here, we hauled some heavy loads out of Fairbanks because we had that Tanana River water to work on.
So that made it
deeper and higher and wider, you bet.
Mm-hmm. Is siltation also a factor here? Or,
well, not so much now. No. It was in those days, of course.
Mm-hmm.
The sandbars are constantly changing.
When I read Joanne Wold's book, This Old House, she talked about one of the best parts of her trip up to the area was taking the riverboat up, and what a wonderful time they had traveling up. But they got caught on several sandbars, and it was quite an adventure.
I'm sure that's part of it. You know, as a riverboat pilot of some time here in the interior, people oftentimes ask me if I've ever been stuck on a sandbar. I tell them I have a white hair in my head for every time I've been aground.
For anyone who hasn't seen Jim Binkley, he has a lot of white hairs.
All
his hair is white. And he has a good head of hair. So we have more trouble with sandbars here in these river systems than, say, in the Mississippi. And
Mississippi's pretty well controlled now. In its wild days, the Missouri, Ohio, Mississippi waterway was much like the Tanana, Yukon, Koyukuk waterways.
So the Mark Twain stories that come out of that was comparable to what it...
Very much so. Very much so.
And the life from those Mark Twain stories has some kind of... life on the river has some kind of similarity?
Very, very, very comparable. I should say so. Ours is still uncontrolled. The river's uncontrolled, relatively. And there are no markers, no channel buoys, no aids to navigation, just like it was in the Midwestern rivers in the early days.
And the only way you can learn how to read the river is trial and error and experience.
You'd be taught by another pilot. You start pilots to read the currents and the channels in the river at a pretty early age. It takes quite a while to catch on to it.
Okay, so when did you first start in the business? How old were you?
Well, when I first started boating, I was about 19. I'm not going to tell you how many years ago that was.
Okay, that's right. We'll let people figure it out. You were 19, and your father was, by then, was he still working?
My father died when I was just a boy. My two uncles operated for some time, and I worked with them. And I had occasion to work with some of the very, very famous old pioneer rivermen, including Charlie Adams, who owned the Lavelle Young that actually founded Fairbanks. I worked as pilot for him during World War II on a steamer called the Barry Kay out of Nenana, hauling supplies to Galena.
And you just picked up, you just worked in Alaska, or did you go all the way down to Seattle?
No, I worked in Alaska. I was born in Wrangell in southeastern Alaska. Came here to attend the University of Alaska, by the way, and started working my way through school by working on the river.
And so you started right out being an apprentice pilot? Or?
Yes, you bet. I started actually in southeastern Alaska and learned the basics of what was involved, and then I added to my store of knowledge while I was here.
How many boats are still traveling up the Yukon?
Of sternwheelers, there are none on the Yukon. The only true sternwheelers that are operating on the rivers of the interior are ours, Discovery and Discovery 2. There are a number of tugboats operating out of Nenana, propeller-type tugboats.
And barges?
Yes, barges, absolutely. You see, you put the freight on the barges, push the barges ahead of you with the tug or the sternwheeler.
How many tugboats and barge combinations work?
I'd have to make a guess right now. I would say there may be as many as 10 that operate out of Nenana.
Have a fairly regular schedule
during
the summer months.
Oh, yes, absolutely. They have a great commitment of freight to deliver in the course of a summer. Mm-hmm. Keeps them very busy.
All the building equipment and fuel and so on out.
Yes, military supplies
to
Galena, miners, traders, trappers.
So it's the more usual way now to put them on the put these supplies on the train to Nenana and then load them.
Transship them on barges downriver.
Rather than coming up from
up the
mouth,
way.
Which was more typical.
Of the earlier days, yes. They came all the way up from the coastal cities, Portland, Seattle, Vancouver, up the Pacific coast, the coast of British Columbia, southeastern Alaska, through the Gulf of Alaska, out through the Aleutian Chain, mm-hmm. up through Bristol Bay, the Bering Sea, and offloaded their freight to the riverboats at the mouth of the Yukon and on up the Yukon River. Long.
Long trip.
Long haul, you bet.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the start of your business. And Mary, you were involved from the very beginning, 1950, and tell me about the boat you first started with.
Okay, that's when I first became involved in this, and Jim and I had just been married 3 years at that time, and the summer of 1950 was when our second son was born. We started with a little missionary boat. We purchased it on a lease purchase basis from the Episcopal Church here in Fairbanks, and the boat was the Godspeed. I'm sure there are many people locally that remember it well. It was built for the Second Episcopal Bishop of Alaska, Bishop Bentley, to travel during the summer months the Tanana and the Yukon Rivers, and he would stop at the villages and the fish camps and take care of some services and maybe marriages and baptisms and along the way. And then when Bishop Gordon came into Alaska in 1948, the youngest bishop that the church had, he decided the boat was very slow for him. It kept him away all summer long from his family. So he'd learned to fly an airplane, and by 1950, they were looking for a buyer for the boat. And so we decided that with the encouragement of the beginning of tourism, and really here was Chuck West, and he knew that Jim was a boat builder and a pilot, so he contacted us and asked us if we'd be interested in starting some river trips at that time, something additional than just the regular sightseeing trip for people to do in Fairbanks. So sounded like a good idea as a second job. So Jim took the boat and extended the decks and put the railings on to meet the Coast Guard regulations, and we could get 25 people aboard.
That was not a sternwheeler.
No, it was a tunnel boat.
What's a tunnel boat?
One with a recess in the bottom so the propeller is not way down in the water, and it gives you a little more shallow draft.
I see. So, and how long did you operate that?
Let's see, that summer, that was our very first summer, we carried a total of like 235 people. We just thought that was a terrific thing as a second job. And we operated it until the summer of 1955, and our smaller stern wheeler, Discovery, was built in the backyard that early spring and summer. I think we must have launched it in maybe July, something like that. So we used the Godspeed up until that time.
And did it as a second job.
Mm-hmm. Jim was working full-time evening shifts.
On boat.
I worked here at the university, the power plant, for some time, and also maintained all of the mechanical things at the hospital in town, the old hospital in downtown Fairbanks.
So you were not working regular, well...
Worked at a full-time job doing that and did right. The business on the side, you see.
Those
getting it started.
To work on the river means some very irregular hours.
Absolutely.
If you work on
you bet.
Tugs, you're really gone for two, 3 months.
Well, it would be if you were a tugboat. But this type of business that we had, where you had excursions, you see, I could take time to do it in the afternoon.
Right, but
prior to that time, I was gone for a long time, you bet.
Right, that's...
I prefer being home every day.
Right. And now you are. So... This the first stern wheeler that you built, did you build this from scratch or did
yes.
you start with?
Yes, no, right from scratch. We built that from the bottom up right in our backyard.
Where did you...
on University Avenue.
...do the research on...
Well, you see, I had a background in that, so mm-hmm. it was easy to visualize what was going on. And in order to build a licensed passenger vessel, one must have plans approved by the U.S. Coast Guard prior to starting a construction. Huh. And also, according to American Bureau of Shipping Standards, which are very rigid... I did all of the preliminary work on it, drew up the rough design of what I wanted, took it to a naval architect friend of mine who was in Seattle, a fellow whom I had met during World War II while sailing out in the Aleutian Chain, and he converted those drawings of mine to ones that would be acceptable to and approved by the Coast Guard. And we did receive that approval. On that basis, we just started. So I built a little workshop in our backyard on University Avenue and did all the steel fabricating of the frames and so on. And then as soon as the weather was good enough, we started putting it together. Built the original hull upside down. And it's an interesting one to build upside down because there's a lot of shear to it, which is a curve, fore and aft curve, like a long rocking chair curve. And then it had crown to it going the other way. And there were some difficult lines to work out. As an amateur boat builder, I did reasonably well. We got it all put together.
At least seaworthy.
Absolutely. You see, it has to undergo very rigid inspection by the Coast Guard every year. You have to undergo tests for stability of the vessel and safety and construction procedure and health standards and fire safety and these things. And they stay right on you, and that's a good thing. We like that because it keeps us on our toes.
Mm-hmm. Boat building, when I have been in shipyards, it's just an amazing procedure. It's very complex. It seems, at least to me, as someone who doesn't do either things, more complex than building construction.
It's entirely different because everything that you do in a boat is different. There are no same things where you can cut lots of things out and then geometrically put them together. You just don't do that in a boat. Everything is handmade. Almost everything. And it's all different. And it's a neat challenge.
So there are then two important things before you got here. Mary and I were talking about the amount of construction and renovation and changes that you do. It's the building projects are ongoing.
There's no end to it. Absolutely no end to it. We are constantly seeking better ways of doing things, do a better job for our visitors that we entertain on our boats all the time, for their greater comfort, better sound system, better... the riding motion to the boat, better seating, better air conditioning, better heating, better programming. Well, air conditioning by using lots of air. If you condition the air, you see, I sometimes say that I condition it with the hot air that comes out of the speakers. That's a type of air conditioning.
Type of air conditioning. Is there such a thing as an authentic stern wheel? I mean, stern wheel just means that the wheel's on the stern.
Yeah, that's about as good a description as you'd give of it. But if you want authenticity, you have to say, what are we going to authenticate? Is it going to be an Alaska stern wheeler, one of the Mississippi type, or some other type of stern wheel vessel, of which there are a number? The Alaska type stern wheelers are very simple, relatively austere compared to those on the Mississippi.
Why is that?
Well, I think because here we were more interested in just moving goods and people as fast as possible. There it was a an established method of transportation. And people were doing what we're doing now, is adding more comforts and conveniences.
They had to carry the gamblers and
absolutely,
so on
you
and so forth, up
whole,
and down
the whole thing. But I think authenticity, if it were steam-operated, that would be authentic to Alaska Early Day Sternwheelers. Otherwise, ours are very, very close. We don't use steam because the regulations and restrictions for steam are just prohibitive, expense-wise and physically.
Did they, when they were operating with steam, did they use wood?
Yes, when I first started, they were burning wood for fuel.
How, take a lot of wood to...
Give me an example of that. In the early days when the woodcutters would cut wood for us, they do it by hand, with a handsaw and an axe. Now, it would take a superman to cut a cord of wood, split it, and stack it where the steamboats could get at it in a day. Tough to do. We burned a cord of wood an hour on the boats.
Oh, my goodness. So there were, you were employing quite a few crews out there stacking wood along the bank.
Usually it was done by private individuals.
Uh-huh.
There were established wood camps at various places, and some people made their living entirely by cutting wood for steamers when there were lots of them on the river. But in the days that I was on there, there were a couple of good wood camps. But trappers and other people along the river would cut wood in the wintertime between seasons and bank it out, that is, stack it on the bank and ready to go. Usually they'd have a jar by the wood pile, and inside be the data on the wood, who cut it, when they cut it, how much they cut, and where they did business. So that when we took wood, the purser would take note of that, and he'd leave a check in the amount appropriate at the nearest trading post.
What a nice system. As the keynote speaker at the commencement was saying, you know, that the North in general has a tradition that we must follow the golden rule and be very neighborly, because it can mean someone's survival, not to leave a cabin open with food and kindling ready to go in cases of stress. And here we go with the fuel for the riverboats, which is quite similar. To
let me give you another example of something very similar to that. Oftentimes when we were moving downriver or upriver, someone wanted something at an individual or isolated camp, they would hang a little flag out over the water. Just a rag or a shirt tail on a stick means that there was somebody there that needed something. We always stopped. They could be sick, injured, whatever. So we checked in to see what they wanted. But usually it was supplies that they required. If we didn't want to stop the big boat and barges, we'd send a small boat over to investigate. Well, if they weren't there, they'd leave a message for us. And most of the time it would be in a Prince Albert tobacco can tied to the stick that held the flag, and in there would be a message as to what they required. And if they required groceries, and they knew about what it would cost, they'd leave the currency there to pay for it. Always more than enough.
Mm-hmm.
And here's one that'll surprise, I suppose, many of your listeners, is that I've seen times when they leave a blank check with their signature on it, with instructions to fill in how much they owed us. Now that's trust, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. That is. And it was a kindness. Presumably the people who were handling this kind of thing, you didn't make any money from these
courtesies. Oh, no. As a matter of fact, it would cost money, really, if you
just
figured it out. Cost money to stop, but it was part of the way of doing things. It was
mm-hmm.
just part of the way of the living in the place, code of the country.
Because we constantly talk now about transportation being a main factor in the expense of things that we purchase in Alaska, and there you were essentially offering transportation for free.
Absolutely. Under some circumstances, we would. Passengers from point to point without charging it for them many times.
Is it, this is sort of off the point, but do you think the prices that are charged now for getting goods out to some of these villages is, it's not, obviously it's not prohibitive, or it is prohibitive, but they don't have a choice?
I think it's competitive enough. Most of the stuff that moves to the villages now, I would say, moved by air. And that's a very competitive business.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're charging too much, a competitor is going to take over your business. On the river, there's competition on the river, too, competition from airplanes for certain mm-hmm. commodities. And I think that the prices are commensurate with the effort it takes to get them there,
mm-hmm.
the costs involved
mm-hmm.
in doing it. I know sometimes it seems rather high, but then some of the costs that are incurred by the person providing transportation are beyond the ken of the ordinary person. It's just
mm-hmm.
incredible expense involved,
mm-hmm.
some of these things. Our business is the same way. We have expenses that are almost terrifying.
give you pause. Well, I know some people who have done some welding for you, and so I know that you, in fact, something that the general public doesn't see, that you're employing quite a crew during several months in the winter to work on the boats.
That's very true. We do that. Now, see, when we're doing our own work, we have the steel shipped up here, and our sons and I do the layout work. We do the fitting and so on, and then to do all of that welding and the amounts that we do it, we couldn't possibly do it ourselves. So we hire a number of welders to weld for us. And there's a lot of skilled help here, very fine help, very fine people, and they are great help to us. But we do hire a lot of people. Also, in the middle of the summer, we hire perhaps as many as 15 or 20 people in our regular daily operations.
Getting that number of people on and off the boat is...
There's a lot of things involved in a business of that kind.
Okay, let's... talk for a minute about how many trips a day that you take. Has that increased through the years?
Yes, it has. I usually do the scheduling, most of it, and we've offered a daily afternoon trip, 4 hours from 2 to 6 o'clock for many years now, and then we have made extra trips. We always charter in the evenings to local groups, and we don't advertise those, but so many times during a week we have a charter usually going out from 7 o'clock to 10 o'clock.
When you do the afternoon trips, do you take both boats?
Sometimes we do. In the middle of summer, July particularly, is a very busy time. Sometimes the last part of June or the middle part till the middle part of August. And then one boat will go out maybe at 1:30 and the second boat at 2 o'clock on the regular trip for 4 hours.
So that way you can load passengers. Mm-hmm. How many people does each of... Now, you're operating two sternwheelers now and have for how long?
Well, the second sternwheeler, Discovery 2, was put into operation during the summer of 1971.
We were talking before about that. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that boat that you did not build from scratch? Purchased that boat?
Yes. Discovery 2 was built originally here in Fairbanks about 1953 by the late Captain George Black, and I think he was a well-known personality in the Fairbanks area and all around the Tanana and Yukon Rivers. He did freight work, and this was all steel, and it was used as a freight boat, and he called it the Utana, named from the two rivers that he operated on. And then it was used at various times. The last time it was really used was as a ferry pushing barges across the Tanana River at Nenana before the bridge was built, the highway bridge down there. And we purchased it in 1968. It had a lot of hard wear on it at that time, so we stripped it down and took out the old machinery, the engine, and replaced them all, redid the superstructure, made it into a passenger vessel, working in some in the summer, but we were quite busy to put in too much effort then, but into the fall and early winter, and then in the spring again. I think they enclosed it with styrofoam one whole winter and had a furnace installed in there and did a lot of the welding and the steel work. And it was launched and ready to go in July of 1971. I think it was licensed for 335.
Yes, originally.
At the time. And we've been operating it since, and then doing a lot of work the last few years in it, making it longer, 16 feet longer, and building a larger stern wheel on it, widening it by 5 feet, moving windows out in the second deck, the middle deck. Now we can seat almost 200 people under cover. We get those occasional rainy days.
Yes, unfortunately. I hope we don't have too much this summer. I'm really
crossing my
fingers.
Kind of interesting.
Hot, dry one.
That the only thing left of the old Utan are some of the deck plates.
So you started with an actual boat, but
yes,
you've ended up with a new one anyway.
An entirely new boat. As a matter of fact, when customs add measures a boat, boats are measured and a certain tonnage is declared and your documents are prepared from that data. When a boat is completely rebuilt, they give you a rebuild on your document, and a boat has to be essentially a new boat to get a rebuild, and that's what we have on ours now. So it's considered a different boat, brand new boat.
When Mary and I were talking, she said, well, they cut it in half, and then they put the... Which is sort of amazing, but of course you can do that with steel.
Sure you can. That's right. It's just a matter of procedure.
It isn't in any way weakening. It's just a totally different material to work with than wood.
Right?
I mean, you know, I think that's. I guess I'm just sort of having to shift gears, because that would just be so much trouble if you were using wood.
Well, it'd be difficult. But my dad did that in Dawson in about 1910, I believe. He cut a steamer called the Vidette in half, a wooden steamer, and pulled it apart with a team of horses, and built a section in the center of it. He put close to 30 feet in the center of that boat in the early days. So it's not you can be done with wood also if you do it right. But it's a little more difficult.
And a lot of work.
I should say so.
Now this has just occurred to me. Do most people who work on who do the jobs on the boat also have building skills?
Not really. I think that's within the family. And then when we need that additional skill, we go out and hire it when we require it. Our family is the operating nucleus of the business. Our daughter, Marilee, and my wife, Mary, work together on the office work and the paperwork, the reservations and the scheduling. And they have an absolute genius on setting up these schedules that can be so complicated in the summertime. And they do just a marvelous job of doing that. Now, one of our sons is responsible for all the mechanical work. He does all the mechanical things, and the mechanical things are his responsibility. If he needs our help, then he calls on it. Our other son is in charge of the crew and operations and cosmetics. Keeps everything looking nice and keeps the crew operating, functioning properly. Then we have hostess that we hire, on usually Alaska girls, and Mary and Marilee work with those girls. So you see, ours is an entertaining trip, really.
Uh-huh.
It is an entertaining trip. We are relating to people the life that we have lived and how we live it, and we're also relating to them how young Alaskans and older Alaskans live right now, because we're looking at them as we go along the river. So we explain to people what our lifestyle here is.
What kind
latitude.
Of now it's possible that much of our audience in fact has taken this trip, but what kind of things do you see on the trip? I live in your neighborhood actually, so I know there's a dog team across the river right at the end of Anderson Road, and you go by and you talk to them, and they always talk back.
Yeah, that's really neat. If Mrs. Verbeek happens to hear the boat coming, she'll sing to her dogs out the window, and they just sing beautifully.
They do. I always know when you're going by, and I like it. You know, it's not in any way a disturbance.
People are surprised. They're gratified. They're amazed that these dogs are singing for them. Well, we see so many things. You know, we pass by the little airport on the bend of the river, right? Fouts Field, where there's so many bush ships, and to some people this in itself is an amazing sight.
Mm-hmm.
And we pass by the pump house, which was part of the old mining scene during Gold Rush days in the mouth of Cripple Creek that produced so much gold in its day, about which Fairbanks had its economy at one time.
Mm-hmm.
Then we see some marvelous log houses that people are building along the way.
One fabulous one with huge amount of sod roof.
Oh my, I should say, and others that are striking in their design. And then we talk about some of the problems of building and how young couples build and get started, and what they do, both people working at a job and working on their house when they can by the light of the midnight sun. You bet.
I've done several shows, home fire shows, on building, and we've talked about the sort of unique situation we have in Alaska, where a lot of people feel that they want to build their own and make their own discoveries and also their own mistakes. And
well, we relate that to people. And then we see the Tanana River in itself, you know, is an exciting river. That's considered perhaps the biggest glacial-fed stream anywhere. And it's an interesting stream to navigate. We see things along the Tanana. We see the changing channels, changing the color of the water, and we talk about the bed load that moves in there and about the geology of the area and about the anthropology and all sorts of things. And we have established a little old Indian fish camp on the bank itself that's not inhabited.
Uh-huh.
We don't have people there. We have dogs there.
It's kind of a museum.
It is a replica of the old Indian fish camps of the river. We have a permit to run a fish wheel 7 days a week, with a proviso that we turn the fish to the river.
Uh-huh.
That's fine with us,
so
as long as we can do it.
The wheel catches the fish, and then the fish go back in.
And then we stop at the Howard Luke trapping camp on an island down in the river, spend some time there at Howard's place, and our hostess take people ashore in groups and explain to them something about the lifestyle of that bush type living years ago. Howard has a marvelous camp, and he incidentally is doing just a marvelous job himself teaching Indian culture to young Indian people. So it gives you a nice rounded
He's lived
look.
In there for a long time.
Oh my, you bet he has, for years and years.
Since 1937.
since 1937.
At that one spot.
And he's had a trap line. Does he still...
He still does a limited amount of trapping. As a matter of fact, he was here at the university this last winter teaching Indian culture to some of the students here at the University of Alaska. And he does just a marvelous job of helping to preserve that terrific culture that they have, because it's so easy for it to get lost.
Yes, it's amazing. You think that something's here and it's always going to be here, and though so many of those subsistence way of life, in fact, are still an active, a real strong part of life along the rivers, but you're quite right that it goes quickly without even with us not even realizing it. You think it's always going to be here, and suddenly it becomes less and less viable a way of living, and there's this rush to do things the new way.
Well, I think that's what we amplify on our trip, are those things that have been so much of Alaska's colorful past, and then relate it to the young people, who many of whom are carrying on those traditions of Alaskan lifestyle.
Yeah, I had a brief conversation with Pauline Carlo sometime this winter, and she said it was interesting to her that many of the youngsters who grew up in the village, they want to get away and do more modern kinds of jobs, but that there's an influx of people who didn't grow up in Alaska, or if they did, they grew up in urban areas, and they want to go out and do the more traditional lifestyle. I understand it's more and more difficult to run a successful trap line.
Well, I think it is getting more difficult, particularly in an area like this where there's so many people who want to do it on a part-time basis. There has to be an overlap of that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. So you must have met a lot of interesting people. You must meet most of the tourists in Fairbanks, and tourism has been good recently and increasing.
I think it's our second largest industry statewide, and really a very important one to the whole Fairbanks economy. And I like to point out it's one of the few industries that is statewide. You feel the effects of tourism all over the state, so it's an important one to all of us.
How many tourists do we have in Fairbanks? How many did we have last year?
Oh, I couldn't tell you. Maybe Jim knows that the Convention Bureau has those figures, and I'm bad at remembering numbers.
I dislike quoting figures because somebody will hold you to it.
And let's make a
guess, 100,000,
okay,
perhaps, visitors in Alaska.
Give or take 20,000. I just wanted some kind of basic idea.
Well, they leave a lot of money in town. You realize that's cash money that comes in from someplace else, and they leave it right here in this community. It's new dollars that come in,
mm-hmm,
and it's a significant part of the Fairbanks economy.
Do you think that we're going to see even more tourists here this summer with our celebration?
Absolutely. You bet we will.
I saw the preview of the Palace Show this year, and it's very much celebrating statehood. It includes statehood song, and it's all in blue and gold, and it's wonderful. And I think that we have some really nice things for tourists that are really what they want, what they expect. Salmon Bake and the Palace Saloon and Riverboat Discovery. I mean, they're privately owned and they're commercial to some extent, but they're very true to the kind of typical things that...
There are many things to see and do in Fairbanks. Fairbanks is becoming visitor-oriented, and people who are starting things in town, we have things all over Fairbanks. It would take me minutes to describe them all, and they're well done, well done. We get a good response from the visitors here as to how Fairbanks receives them. Of course, we have a few that are unhappy, and you're going to find that any place in the world. But by and large, most visitors here are very, very happy with Fairbanks. As a matter of fact, I think in surveys, Fairbanks receives the highest mark of any city for visitors.
Because we've got a golden heart, or because
I think
we're friendly.
That we're friendly, outgoing people, and we live natural lives. We just live our lives, and we share that with people. And I think people respond to that.
Do you think when there are problems, it's that people have a very different image of what to expect here than what they find? They don't expect Safeways. They want it to be...
Partly that. And partly there are those who you couldn't satisfy anyhow.
Right.
If they can't find anything wrong, give them time, they'll find something. But there are those types, and there are people like that.
Mm-hmm.
But 99% of the folks that come up here are warm and friendly, and they receive Fairbanks very well.
So you're feeling you don't get burned out working with the public all the time? You think that it's rejuvenating?
Well, I think it's really exciting, and it's something that you feel a lot of satisfaction from. It's so different from working in an office, because every day you hear from the people what they feel, and they respond, and they're just very grateful for information and being told authentic information, and on a personal basis, they really do. They come up here, they spend thousands of dollars to come here, and it is more like a foreign travel experience, but they want to meet the Alaskans, they want to know about the history, and that's what we like to tell them, and they are appreciative.
Both of you do running commentary, obviously, on different...
Yes, we both do it, right. I do probably the major amount of it, and then when we have two boats, why, Mary takes one boat and I take the other. And then when I need a little rest, why, she steps in and takes over for me, and vice versa. But we do most of the commentary ourselves. Our daughter is just beginning to do that, and she does very well.
You've just developed that over the years. Have you changed it, or you change it on a day-to-day basis?
Changes,
or?
Every day. We have no formal way of presenting it. And it's interesting that each crowd of people has their own personality. The people are influenced by other personalities in a crowd, and they respond to different things. And we have developed techniques of answering that and fulfilling that response, fulfilling that need that they have for whatever it is that they like. And it's rare that you find a group that doesn't express itself as a group in some manner. And we have little things that we develop through the years, little test phrases that we use to see how they respond to it and what they like. And we do a tremendous amount of research. If we are pulling anybody's leg, they know it right off the bat. But actually, in the saying that this is a story about something, they know we're telling them a fun. But everything that we do is as authentic as we can possibly get it. We do lots of research. We use the university here and our own research facilities. We have just a reservoir of information on things. And sometimes when we're stumped, we're quick to say, I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that question.
Mm-hmm.
We have radio on the boat. We get on the radio and get an answer to that before the trip's over.
Oh, really?
You bet.
See, someone who can do a little calling around to you.
Absolutely. And all the agencies, I want to congratulate the university and the federal government and the state government. The agencies that we use to get information are quick and responsive, and they're a delight to work with.
Well, I think that there's great pride in Alaska, and I think we do want to... people from outside to have the most accurate information about us. It's amazing to me when I go outside how much misinformation there is about Alaska, how absolutely fantastical their ideas of what life is like up here. And I think we've spent quite a bit of money trying to give an accurate and correct picture, because we also don't want to display and present ourselves as a land of unbelievable opportunity in terms of jobs, because we do have a real high unemployment rate, seasonally at least, and there aren't jobs for everyone. So, but I think people's information may be improving now that we're spending a little more money that way.
You know, we have the most unique approach to advertising in this state. Ours is considered the standard of excellence by all the other 49 states. Imagine such a thing. Here we have industry and the state pooling their money and advertising from that pool of money, using the expertise of the entire industry and the state to effectively get out there and get this business. And the rest of the country wonders how we can possibly do it.
How did we?
Well, we did it just because the Alaska Visitors Association, which is a group of people in the visitor industry, who said, why don't we get together with you, Division of Tourism in the state, and help you in any way we can get your information out, help you disseminate the things that we think are effective and needed. And the state said, I think that's a great idea. We don't have all the answers. So the state accepted the cooperative marketing program between the two entities. And the arm of the state takes its money, advertising money, puts it in a fund, and the industry people in the state contribute their money to it. And together we have a pretty good hard-selling group working on it, and it's extremely effective, mm-hmm. extremely effective.
So you work on telling people what they can do when they
There are several different kinds of advertising. Some of this is very sophisticated stuff, and we're competing with some of the toughest destinations in the world. We're competing with Hawaii, with Mexico, with South America, with the Caribbean, with Bermuda, with the whole works, and other states that have big travel budgets. New York City is a big one. And we're right in there. We're doing extremely well. But ours is competition with them is to, first of all, to realize that Alaska is a place that they would like to visit, number one. And then next, how do they go about doing it? You got to turn that interest into, you got to convert it into people who get here.
Well, in some ways, I know that there are a number of Fairbanksans that don't feel that they particularly benefit, or at least they don't sense that they benefit directly from tourists, and so the increase in traffic and so on can be an annoyance for people who want the place to stay small and quaint and so on. But in some ways, it makes quite a bit of sense as an industry because we have seasonal constraints. This is not such a nice pleasant place in January. I may be unique in feeling that, but but there is that, and the fact that people are using their own transportation. It's a difficult place to develop industry because then we have to ship products out or ship supplies in, and so tourism makes a certain amount of sense in that.
Non-extractive, doesn't take anything from the country. All it takes is a pleasant smile and show the things that are pleasant to them. They take back good memories and send other people who are going to spend more money in our community. People don't realize, I think many people don't realize, where the money comes from to operate a town like Fairbanks. The impact of the payroll at the University of Alaska, what the University of Alaska means to this community, the significance of it to our community is strong. I wonder how many people really realize that. We know that the military spends some money here, that the oil people do. We're a supply center of the interior, and the visitor industry is very much a significant part of that.
Well, we really don't have any other
that's true.
Industry.
That's it. Maybe we don't want any.
Maybe
I don't know.
Maybe we don't want any. Well, there are some just constraints based on our location.
Surely.
Periodically people talk about computer chips or something because it's easy to put that in the airplane.
Sure.
But then we have labor costs, which are fairly high here, and that makes us non-competitive in a lot of fields. You see continued growth in Fairbanks? You don't see a...
Well, from that point of view, sure, there has to be growth in Fairbanks. Gosh, when I first came here, the population was about 3,500. 3,500. That's a tremendous growth through the years. We've seen it through the gold-producing years, through World War II, through post-World War II, through the geographical changes in what's going on, oil exploration, oil development, oil production, and from the state. When I was in the legislature in the state in the 1960s, we had a budget of $100 million. Imagine that. That's not all that long ago. And the budget is today approaching a $4 billion.
I know, it's
that's development and change.
That's one way to describe it.
Some who wouldn't call it development. With
well, it's change. Like let's put it that way. Yeah, I don't want to get into a philosophical discussion of what we should or should not do in the community, because everybody has an opinion on that. But I feel this way about the visitor industry, that it is a nice, clean industry.
Well, this year, I think it bears some thinking about, because we are really gearing up for this celebration of the anniversary of statehood, and so I think that we probably can expect more than usual. Are you doing anything special to commemorate this?
I think we do something special every year as far as Alaska is concerned, and this, of course, is a milestone on our path along the way, and an exciting thing, and we mention that each day, that this is our 25th anniversary of statehood. And of course, we're asked many questions by people. Do you like statehood? What's happened since you became a state? And so on. And we rarely express a personal opinion.
Oh, is that right?
Rarely do that. Well, that leads
diplomatic
that leads to controversy, and that's not what we're selling.
Right.
After the trip, if somebody wants to talk philosophy of living, well, that's fine. I'm glad to do that.
You are taking school children now. And what time did... I asked you before, when did you first put the boats in the river this year? When is the typical time that you first start?
The boats really were in the river all winter long.
Right.
They were frozen in. And I think it was about the 14th of May that But this is the end of the second week, and the last 2 weeks of school for many years now, we've taken school children on two-hour trips. It's their field trips, and many of them participate. Many don't because we have a limited amount of time available. So there are two-hour trips in the mornings for the children, and this is the very last one at the nursery school today.
How do you rotate that around? The schools just call you up and request
it? Well, we put it in a bulletin that goes out to the teachers. It goes to most teachers in April sometime, and then if they're interested in having a field trip, they call us. And it's a very nominal fee for them, and some mothers go along and bring the smaller, younger brothers and sisters, and sometimes there are grandparents visiting that go also. And some of the schools just stick to strictly their school children. With the teachers, it's lots of fun for us too. Sometimes a little bit hectic with certain age groups. There's a lot of movement, and you have to be watching all the time to make sure that they don't climb. And
the energy level at the end of school just seems to escalate on a daily basis. I mean, kids just get more and more frenzied. I think that would, if I were a teacher, I'd be definitely up for a riverboat ride.
They're spirited. You know, they're a great delight, really. It's a great delight to take these young folks out. They listen intently to some of the things that you tell them about. They're interested in the things that we have to say. Just marvelous. If our future is in the hands of our kids, we're in good shape.
I think there's something very romantic, exotic, I don't know what the word is, about life on the river. Is there any chance that if you're a young person now, you can run away? Like, become part of it. It's sort of like the circus, only in a different way. Something that you'd like to do. Maybe that's because they've just read a lot of Mark Twain. But
I suppose that's true, and it is exciting, and it is a neat way of life. And we have no problem in getting first class help. We have lots of young people who want to work with us, and we get some wonderful young people. We have our own alumni association of people who have worked for us in the past who keep in touch with us. Young fellows and girls, we hear about their marriage and their children, and as they grow along, we get cards and letters from them all the time, and it's a great thing. We've become a riverboat family.
Is it possible for young people to get jobs on regular the tugs and the barges?
It's possible.
By just applying,
usually these crews are pretty well filled out pretty early in the year, and most of the time they have returning licensed skilled help, but there are jobs available, and I think it. Somebody who's aggressive and wants to do it can find a way to do it.
That's what I was going to ask you. How you began because some you had family members and your uncles were involved, and so I guess word of mouth, they put in a good word for you.
Oh, sure. And my dad was well known in the interior, so it was no problem for me to find boats to work on. And during World War II, I had occasion to work on and pilot some of the big stern wheelers. The captains and pilots had all been friends of my father, so it was no problem at all for me to move from boat to boat and place to place. And I never wanted to stay on any one boat any length of time. I wanted the experience of different types of boats, different loads, different water, different things. So I was on the move. Ordinarily, a pilot going on a boat is there for a lifetime.
Really?
Absolutely. You get on one vessel, and you might say you're going to stay there a long time, perhaps a lifetime. So that didn't appeal to me so much as knowing more about what's going on in the whole industry, what other boats are doing, what other people think, how they handle it, what the engineers do, what happens in the shipyard.
Since that's not uncommon, if someone has a boat for life, what kind of age, when you were working regularly out there, what kind of age were the
Some of the pilots and captains pilot. That I worked with, some of the ones that I worked with when I was real young, were in their 70s, still piloting. There were only a few young fellows of my generation at that time that were doing that sort of thing. Very few.
How old were you when you first started?
Well, I was 19 when I first started.
But when you got your own boat?
Well, I had my first command, I was about 23 years old.
That's young, isn't it?
It is, very young. But then they needed lots of commanders in those days.
Because they were...
Yeah, we were moving military freight and this sort of thing.
Uh-huh. But that, other than that unusual circumstance, what...
Well, other than that, it would take you a long time to become the master of a vessel. You would get on as in the deck crew, you'd become one of the mates, and then you'd become the first officer, and then perhaps you get a pilot's job, and then you'd pretty soon you'd become a master after the master retired or did something else. So it's a long, progressive thing.
So maybe in your 40s or 50s.
Yeah, that'd be about right, where you could move into that.
And so then by then you keep the boat for...
Sure, you're going to stay there. I didn't like that idea. I'm going to move around and do it. I perhaps have been mate, master, and pilot on 12 or 15 different boats because I had the opportunity. I just moved around and took advantage of it. And it's been a thrilling lifetime.
Any special experiences that stand out?
Oh, sure, there are all kinds of experiences, but, you know, one particular one doesn't come to mind, but there have been
near
a lot,
disasters?
Lot of...
Near disasters?
Oh.
Those are the things that...
Near disaster.
Obviously
yeah,
not
things,
any.
Things, you're on the edge of it in the freighting business oftentimes all the time. You're flirting with it because you're moving heavy loads under very difficult conditions, and it becomes the routine to be right on the edge of problems. I've had some tight situations in my time. I had one of my deckhands fall overboard in a very treacherous place one time and ran over him with two barge loads of freight in the swift water. And he popped up right alongside the engine room door in the Tanana River down near the mouth, and I was in the wheelhouse, and I was a long ways down to the deck. Early in the morning, no other people on duty. One fellow standing beside me, I told him to take over and rang the engines off. And I roused another fellow on deck, and we got a skiff over the side and saved him. But everything happened to us on that thing. I tried to jump from the wheelhouse down to the deck, broke the rail, managed to get there. And in the Tanana River, it can be very difficult. So if he was in there too long, we'd never get to him. But we just did get him, and our boat leaked, and it almost capsized on us. But we did get him back again, and that probably was the closest situation that I've been involved in.
Well, that I think that speaks very well for a long career. Because these rivers are extremely dangerous.
They can be if you let them be. If you're on top of it, then they're not dangerous. In our business, it could be if we didn't do it right, and we do it right. And the Coast Guard knows that it can be difficult, and they're satisfied with the kind of a job that we do. I had a fellow newspaper reporter ask me if I'd ever had any close calls, and he was amused at my response. I said, nothing we couldn't handle.
That's right. They all look fine once you're out of them.
Right.
How long do you stay in the water for the season?
Is about 120 days, and that varies with the weather. Mary schedules it as soon as we can possibly do it, and then we keep going just as late as we can. But 120 days is about our season. That's our operating season. We have another 120 days that we put in on maintenance on top of that.
But so you run into September?
You bet we do.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope that we have a very good weather year this year. I'm always hoping for really dry, hot ones because that's what makes the gardens grow. But amazingly enough, I think people, when they come to Alaska, are fairly tolerant of weather differences.
Yes, they are.
And you run every day no matter what the weather is.
Every day. We don't miss a day.
You get used to bad weather.
Well, we're enclosed. We're warm. Mm-hmm. We can see the same things, talk about the same things. Mm-hmm. It's no different, really.
Do you have any predictions on how the weather's going to be this summer?
Perhaps? Not a one. I wish I did, but maybe it's best not to know.
Whatever it is, we're gonna do it.
That's something that if you live on the river, you work on the river, you're not so worried about.
Not really, no.
That's not.
Not really, no. High water, low water, we put up with those things. That's part of it. That's just part of operating.
Are the rivers high this year or
no, they're
normal?
Quite low, very low. But that's because we've had a cool spring, cool nights, not too much glacial activity yet.
Glaciers gradual melt.
Yes. It'll come on strong here very soon.
Because of more...
Yes, the more heat we have and the more glaciers melt, the more the Tanana River rises. As the Tanana rises, it causes the Chena to rise.
The demarcation between the Chena and the Tanana are quite incredible.
Fascinating.
Really interesting for anyone who hasn't been at that junction, what a difference it is.
People don't realize how much material moves down the Tanana River.
Uh-huh.
The Corps of Engineers have established a figure of sand and gravel and that glacier flour, that silt fine stuff. Past the mouth of the Chena goes 100,000 tons a day.
It's That's incredible.
It is.
That's incredible. Well, thank you very much, Captain Jim and Mary Binkley, for being with me. I hope you all take advantage of River Trip this summer. It's a really interesting experience, and I'll talk to you next week on the Home Fires Radio Show. Thank you.